A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He grew up watching Friends, like a lot of people did, but he was never a huge fan. It always felt slightly too vanilla to him, though he couldn't quite put his finger on why at the time. What interests him is the gap between watching the show and actually becoming the kind of adult it depicts. That period where your real life either converges with the fantasy or sharply diverges from it. And he's curious how other people digested that, especially the people who loved it and then grew up.
This is a rich one. Because Friends is this weird cultural artifact where the criticism and the nostalgia are both correct at the same time, it's a show that was genuinely beloved, comforting, and also absurd in ways that only became obvious once its original viewers started paying their own rent.
The apartment is the obvious entry point. Monica's place in Greenwich Village. Two bedrooms, spacious living room, exposed brick balcony, would have run something like $4,000 to $5,000 a month in the mid-90s. Even with rent control as the show's hand-wavy excuse, the numbers don't work. Monica is a chef at a diner, then a struggling catering business owner. Rachel works as a waitress for the first two seasons before landing an entry-level fashion job.
A financial planner named Annette Hammertree crunched the numbers and estimated the apartment would cost around $4,500 a month in 1994 dollars. Monica's salary as a sous chef at a mid-tier Manhattan restaurant? Maybe $35,000 a year. Her rent alone would have eaten something like 150% of her take-home pay.
Before the inexplicable quantity of throw pillows.
The show's internal logic is that it's her grandmother's rent-controlled apartment which she's illegally subletting. That's the fig leaf. But even with rent control, the numbers strain credulity. Rent-controlled units in Manhattan in the 90s were not going for $300 a month. Maybe if the grandmother had been there since 1945, but even then, the legal maximum increases would have pushed it higher.
You've clearly thought about this.
I went down a rabbit hole once. I regret nothing.
Here's the thing. I don't think the apartment math actually matters to the show's appeal, or its failure. Nobody watched Friends for a documentary about New York real estate. The apartment is a set, literally and metaphorically. The problem isn't that the economics are unrealistic, it's that the show never acknowledges economics at all.
That's a sharper point. Because there are shows set in New York that do engage with money, rent, jobs, the anxiety of making it. Even Seinfeld, which is famously a show about nothing, has episodes built around money stress. George is constantly worried about unemployment. Elaine has career setbacks. Jerry's financial stability is the exception, and the show knows it.
Friends has one episode where money becomes an actual plot point. The one where Rachel, Phoebe, and Joey can't afford to go to a nice dinner with Monica, Chandler, and Ross. And it's resolved by the end of the episode. The inequality between the friends is acknowledged, then neatly shelved.
Season 2, Episode 5. The one with five steaks and an eggplant. It's a landmark episode precisely because it's the only time the show directly confronts the economic disparity in the group. Ross and Chandler have stable corporate jobs. Monica gets promoted to head chef. Meanwhile, Joey is a struggling actor, Phoebe is a masseuse, and Rachel is still a waitress. The tension is real for about 22 minutes, and then it's resolved with a group hug.
That's the template. Friends raises adult problems, money, career, relationships, family dysfunction, and then resolves them within the sitcom structure. The laugh track tells you when to feel better. The stakes reset by the next episode.
Which brings us to the other big criticism, the one that's more uncomfortable. The show presents a version of New York that is almost surgically white and straight.
The prompt mentions this. The interracial coexistence that even in New York may increasingly not exist. And Friends was set in Manhattan in the 90s, one of the most diverse places on Earth.
Aisha Harris wrote about this incisively years ago. The show had exactly two recurring black characters over 10 seasons. Charlie, Ross's paleontology colleague, played by Aisha Tyler, who appeared in 9 episodes across seasons 9 and 10, and Kristen, Joey's date, in 1 episode. That's it. In a show with 236 episodes, set in a city that was roughly 25% black at the time.
The carefully curated part of Daniel's prompt is doing a lot of work there. It's not that the show is hostile or bigoted, it's that it's curated. Every person of color who appears is either a love interest or a service worker. The world of the 6 friends is hermetically sealed.
The thing is, that wasn't unusual for 90s sitcoms. Seinfeld was also overwhelmingly white. But Seinfeld wasn't trying to be a warm, inclusive portrait of urban life. It was a show about 4 selfish people. Friends positioned itself as a show about community, about found family, about the city as this great connector, and the city it showed was a fantasy.
Here's where I think the prompt gets interesting, though. It's not asking us to litigate whether Friends was good or bad. It's asking about the experience of watching it and then growing up, the gap between the fantasy and the reality.
And that's a more personal question, because I think a lot of people who watched Friends in their teens or early 20s had a specific kind of relationship with it. It was aspirational, not the apartment, the life. The idea that your 20s would be this decade of hanging out in a coffee shop with your best friends, dating interesting people, having minor career setbacks that resolve in 22 minutes.
The coffee shop itself is the perfect symbol. Central Perk is always half empty. There's always a couch available. Nobody is on a laptop working remotely because they can't afford both coffee and rent. Nobody is having a loud business call. It's a living room with better lighting and a barista who apparently has no other customers.
The silent witness to a decade of romantic drama whose own unrequited love for Rachel is played for laughs. He's basically the show's conscience, and he's a background character.
You watch this in high school or college, and it plants a seed. This is what adult life looks like. Your friends are your real family. You'll see them every day. You'll have time to sit around and talk about relationships for hours. Work is something that happens off-screen.
Then you actually enter your 20s. Suddenly you're working 50 hours a week. Your friends are scattered across boroughs or cities or time zones. Getting 6 people in a room requires a doodle poll and 3 reschedules. Nobody has a coffee shop where they're a regular. You're lucky if you see your closest friend twice a month.
The dissonance hits at different speeds for different people. For some, it's a slow realization. For others, it's a sharp break. A moment where you look at your life and think, wait, this isn't what I was promised.
There's a term for this that's been floating around, the friend's hangover. It's that disappointment that settles in when you realize your 20s are more about student loan payments and awkward roommate situations than witty banter in a perpetually available coffee shop.
Here's the thing. I don't think the show is to blame for that. It's a sitcom. It's not supposed to be a documentary. But I do think there's something worth examining about why this particular show became the template for so many people's expectations.
Part of it is timing. Friends aired from 1994 to 2004. The core audience was Gen X and elder millennials. These were people coming of age in a relatively stable economic period, before the 2008 crash, before the gig economy really took hold. The fantasy of Friends felt achievable because for a brief window, some version of it actually was.
The 90s economy. The peace dividend. New York before 9/11.
The show premiered 3 years after the Cold War ended. The economy was growing. Manhattan was getting safer. The idea that you could move to the city and build a life with your friends didn't seem absurd. It seemed like what people did.
Then the audience aged, and the world changed, and the show didn't. It's frozen in amber, which is why rewatching it now feels so strange. The jokes still land, the chemistry is still there, but the world it depicts feels like a parallel universe.
I want to talk about the chemistry, actually. Because that's the part of the show that critics of the economic and diversity critique sometimes feel is getting lost. The 6 actors work together in a way that's rare. The casting was lightning in a bottle. The comedic timing, the way they played off each other, that's not fake. That's why the show was huge.
No argument here. The show was a phenomenon for real reasons. The writing in the early seasons is sharp. The performances are strong. The Thanksgiving episodes are great television. The pivot scene with the couch is physical comedy at a level most sitcoms never reach.
3 words that will outlive us both.
The show works as entertainment. The question is, what happens when entertainment becomes a life template?
I think the answer depends on when you watched it. If you watched it as a teenager, it was aspirational. If you watched it in your early 20s, it was comforting. If you watched it in your 30s, it started to feel like a lie. And if you watched it in your 40s, it might circle back to being comforting again, because you've made peace with the gap.
It's an interesting arc. The show doesn't change. You do.
The prompt is specifically interested in that period between watching it and becoming the adult it depicts. That's the moment where the fantasy either breaks or gets renegotiated.
For me, the thing that broke first was the friendship density. The idea that you'd see your closest friends every single day, multiple times a day, with no scheduling effort whatsoever. That's not how adult friendship works. That's how high school friendship works, or college friendship, where you're all living in the same building or on the same campus.
The show essentially extends the college social structure into your late 20s and early 30s. Everyone lives within walking distance. Everyone's schedule is magically aligned. Nobody has a commute that takes an hour and a half.
Ross has a PhD and a job at a museum and then a university. And he still has time to hang out at Central Perk at 11 in the morning on a Tuesday.
To be fair, academia does have flexible hours.
Not that flexible. Not spend 3 hours a day in a coffee shop flexible.
The other thing that breaks on rewatch is the relationship timeline. The show treats your late 20s as this endless period of dating and breakups, and will they won't they, which, to be fair, some people do experience. But the show never really grapples with the pressure to settle down, to have kids, to make permanent decisions. When it does introduce those themes, Monica and Chandler's infertility storyline, for example, it handles them with kid gloves.
The infertility arc is a good example of the show's limits. It's treated seriously, but it's also resolved neatly. They adopt twins. The emotional complexity of infertility, the grief, the strain on a marriage, the financial cost, is acknowledged but never really explored. It's a sitcom. It can't go that deep.
That's not a failure of the show per se. It's a category constraint, but it does mean that the show can't actually prepare you for those experiences. It can only offer a comforting story about them.
Which brings us back to the prompt's core question. How did people digest this? What happened when the gap between the show and reality became visible?
I think there are a few common responses. One is rejection. The show is bad, it lied to me, it's propaganda for an unattainable lifestyle. Another is nostalgia. The show is a warm blanket, I know it's unrealistic, I don't care, it makes me feel good. And a third is something more complicated. An appreciation for what the show actually was, which is a well-crafted sitcom that happened to capture something about a particular moment.
I think most people who grew up with it land somewhere in that third category eventually. You stop expecting it to be real and start appreciating it as craft.
The danger is when people never make that adjustment, when they internalize the show's template so deeply that they measure their actual lives against it and find their actual lives wanting.
That's a real phenomenon, though. Social media does the same thing now. A curated highlight reel that makes your own life feel inadequate. Friends was doing that before Instagram existed. It just used a laugh track instead of filters.
The laugh track is doing real psychological work. It's telling you when to find something funny, but it's also telling you when to find something normal. When Chandler makes a sarcastic comment about his parents' divorce, the laugh track says this is comedy, not trauma. When Ross's marriages keep failing, the laugh track says this is a running joke, not a portrait of someone who might be struggling.
The show is full of painful backstories that are played for laughs. Phoebe's mother committed suicide. Her stepfather went to prison. She lived on the streets. Chandler's parents had a traumatic divorce involving a cross-dressing father and a sexually inappropriate mother. Monica was emotionally neglected in favor of Ross. These are not light topics.
The show's treatment of them is uneven. Sometimes it mines them for genuine pathos. More often it mines them for punchlines, which is what sitcoms do. But it does create a weird tonal dissonance when you rewatch as an adult.
The Chandler dad storyline in particular has aged poorly. The show treats his father's gender identity as a punchline over and over. Kathleen Turner played the role in later seasons, and the writing never really moved past. Isn't this weird and funny? By contemporary standards, it's cringeworthy.
That's one of the areas where the show's age really shows. The 90s were not a great decade for LGBTQ representation in mainstream sitcoms. Friends had Carol and Susan, Ross's ex-wife and her partner, who were groundbreaking in some ways. A same-sex wedding on network television in 1996 was a big deal. But they were also largely desexualized and used as a plot device for Ross's discomfort.
The show wanted credit for being progressive while also mining queer identity for jokes. It's a tension that runs through a lot of 90s television.
It connects back to the diversity question. The show's world is narrow, not just racially, but in every dimension. Everyone is thin. Everyone is conventionally attractive. Everyone is cisgender and mostly straight. Everyone is able-bodied. It's a fantasy of homogeneity.
Which, again, is what a lot of escapist entertainment does. The interesting question isn't whether Friends is diverse. It obviously isn't. It's why this particular homogeneity resonated so strongly.
I think it's because the show offered a fantasy of simplicity. Your problems are romantic and professional, not systemic. Your friend group is your entire world. The outside world, politics, race, class, current events, barely exists. The only time real-world events intrude is in the background, like the brief moment where Chandler makes a joke about the 2000 election recount.
9/11 never happens in the Friends universe. The show was filming its 8th season when the attacks occurred. The season premiered in September 2001, just weeks after. The show never acknowledges it. The Twin Towers are still in the establishing shots for several episodes because they've been filmed before the attacks.
That's not a criticism. The show made a choice to remain an escape. But it does underscore how sealed off the Friends universe is. The most consequential event in New York City's modern history happened during the show's run, and the characters never notice.
Which brings me to something I've been turning over. The prompt mentions fans who attack the show on petty and cynical grounds. And I think there's a distinction worth making between valid critique and the kind of performative takedown that's become its own genre.
The actually, Friends is problematic essay.
Which is often less about the show and more about the person writing the essay wanting to demonstrate superior taste. It's a status move. I see through the thing you love. And it's tedious.
At the same time, the critiques aren't wrong. The apartment math doesn't work. The diversity is abysmal. The gender politics are dated. These are true things. The question is what weight you give them.
That's where the prompt's framing is useful. It's not asking whether Friends is good or bad. It's asking about the experience of watching it and growing up. That's a different conversation.
Let's talk about that experience, because I think it varies a lot depending on when you were born and when you first watched.
The show ended in 2004. If you were, say, 15 when it ended, you caught the tail end of its original run and then absorbed the rest through syndication and eventually streaming. By the time you were in your 20s, the show was already a nostalgic object.
If you were born later, if your first exposure was Netflix in the 2010s, the gap is even wider. You're watching a show about the 90s and early 2000s through the lens of the 2010s or 20s. The flip phones are a period detail. The lack of social media is conspicuous. The gender dynamics feel like a time capsule.
The show becomes a period piece without meaning to be. It was made as contemporary entertainment and became historical fiction.
Which is actually a fascinating way to watch it, because you can see the 90s in high resolution. The fashion, the anxieties, the economic assumptions. Friends is a better document of the 90s than it ever intended to be.
The coffee shop culture, for example. Central Perk is very specifically a 90s coffee shop. The oversized mugs, the exposed brick, the acoustic guitar performances. It's pre-Starbucks everywhere. It's the moment when coffee shops were becoming the third place, the spot between home and work where life happened.
That's actually one of the things the show got right. Coffee shops really were becoming that. The show didn't invent the phenomenon, but it captured it and amplified it. Central Perk became the platonic ideal of the coffee shop as social hub.
The show is simultaneously unrealistic about money and surprisingly accurate about social infrastructure. The coffee shop, the apartment as gathering place, the walkable neighborhood. These are real features of urban life that people value. The show exaggerated their accessibility, but it didn't invent their appeal.
That's a generous reading, and I think it's part of why the show endures despite the critiques. It's not just nostalgia. It's that the show depicts a version of community that people actually want. The fantasy isn't the apartment or the coffee shop. It's the density of connection.
Six people who like each other and see each other every day. That's the fantasy. And it's a fantasy because in real adult life, maintaining 6 close friendships is a logistical nightmare. They have kids, they get demanding jobs, they get tired.
The show acknowledges this briefly in the final season, when Monica and Chandler are moving to the suburbs and Rachel is moving to Paris. The group is dissolving. But it's framed as a bittersweet ending, not as the natural consequence of adult life.
Because if it had been framed as natural, the show's entire premise would have been undermined. The fantasy requires that the group stays together. The moment you admit that adult friendship is hard to maintain, the whole thing collapses.
Yet, I don't think that makes the show dishonest. It makes it a sitcom. The genre requires a stable configuration of characters. The Cheers bar, the Seinfeld diner, the Central Perk couch, these are narrative devices. They're not promises.
They function as promises for young viewers who don't yet understand genre conventions. A 15-year-old watching Friends doesn't think, ah yes, the sitcom requires a stable gathering place. They think, cool, when I'm an adult, I'll have a coffee shop where I hang out with my friends every day.
Is that the show's fault, or is it just a category error? We don't blame action movies for making people think car chases are a normal part of law enforcement.
I think it's partly a category error, but I also think Friends occupies a unique cultural position. It wasn't just a popular show. It was a lifestyle aspiration. The haircut, the coffee shop, the apartment, the friend group. These became templates that people actively tried to replicate.
The Rachel haircut alone launched 1,000 salons.
The show was prescriptive in a way that most sitcoms aren't. It told you how to live, or at least it was received that way.
That's where the backlash comes from. If you built your expectations around the show and then reality failed to deliver, you feel duped, even if the show never explicitly promised anything.
The question becomes, what do you do with that feeling? Do you blame the show? Do you laugh at your younger self? Do you rewatch and feel warm despite everything?
I suspect most people do all three, in sequence. The arc I described earlier, aspiration, comfort, disillusionment, reconciliation.
The prompt is specifically interested in the disillusionment phase, the moment where you realize the show's version of adulthood isn't yours.
For me, that moment came when I was in medical residency. I was working 80-hour weeks. I saw my friends maybe once a month. The idea of sitting in a coffee shop for 3 hours on a weekday was laughable, and I remember catching a rerun of Friends in the hospital lounge at 3 a.m, and it felt like it was broadcast from another planet.
The hospital lounge at 3 a.m. is about as far from Central Perk as you can get.
Fluorescent lighting, vending machine coffee, the distant beeping of monitors. Very different vibe.
Did you resent the show in that moment, or did you appreciate the escape?
Both, I think. I resented it for being so disconnected from my reality, and I also understood why people watched it. It was warm, it was comforting, it was a world where problems were solvable in 22 minutes.
That's the paradox of comfort food television. It soothes you precisely because it's unreal. The unreality is the point.
I think that's where a lot of the cynical critiques miss the mark. They treat the unreality as a design flaw when it's actually the core feature. Friends isn't a failed documentary about New York. It's a successful fantasy about friendship.
The question is whether the fantasy is benign. And I think that depends on the viewer. If you can hold the fantasy and reality in your head at the same time, it's fine. If you can't, it can be damaging.
There's been some interesting research on this. Studies on media consumption and life satisfaction suggest that heavy viewers of lifestyle-oriented shows, Friends, Sex and the City, that genre, tend to report lower satisfaction with their own social lives. The comparison effect is real.
Social comparison theory. You measure your life against the curated version you see on screen and find it lacking.
The effect is stronger when the show is set in a recognizable real-world context. Friends isn't set in a fantasy kingdom, it's set in Manhattan. You can go to Manhattan. You can walk past the building they used for the exterior shots. The gap between the show and reality is measurable in actual dollars and actual square footage.
The building is real. It's at 90 Bedford Street in the West Village. The interiors were shot on a soundstage in Burbank. The gap between the exterior and the interior is the gap between the fantasy and the reality.
You can stand outside that building and feel the dissonance directly. The real building is smaller. The neighborhood is quieter. There's no Central Perk on the ground floor. It's a restaurant, I think.
The show is a lie you can visit.
That's bleak.
A little bleak, but also kind of beautiful. Here is a place that millions of people feel connected to, and it doesn't exist. The friendship, the coffee shop, the apartment, none of it is real. And yet the feelings are real. The comfort is real. The laughter is real.
That's the thing the cynical takes can't account for. The emotional experience of watching the show is genuine, even if the depicted world is fabricated. People aren't stupid. They know sitcoms aren't documentaries. But the warmth they feel isn't fake.
That warmth has real value, especially for people who are lonely or going through a hard time or just need a break from their own lives. The show functions as a kind of social surrogate. The characters become familiar presences. The rhythms of the show become reassuring.
There's a term for this in media psychology, parasocial relationships. The one-sided connections viewers form with media figures, and Friends is basically a parasocial relationship generator. The whole show is designed to make you feel like you're part of the group.
The title sequence does this explicitly. The cast dancing in the fountain, the clapping, the direct address to the camera. It's an invitation. Come hang out with us.
For a lot of people, that invitation was meaningful, especially for people who didn't have a strong friend group of their own. The show provided a template and a substitute.
Which circles back to the prompt's question about the gap. If the show was your primary model for adult friendship, and then your actual adult life didn't match, what do you do with that?
I think the healthy response is to recognize the show as a genre piece, and adjust your expectations accordingly. The unhealthy response is to either reject the show entirely as a lie, or to cling to it as a standard you failed to meet.
Most people probably land somewhere in the messy middle. They rewatch, they cringe at some jokes, they still laugh at others, they feel a complicated mix of nostalgia and distance.
That's actually a pretty good description of how we relate to our own pasts. The cringe and the warmth, the distance and the affection. Rewatching Friends is like looking at old photos of yourself. You can't quite believe you wore that, thought that, cared about that, but you also can't quite disown the person who did.
The show becomes a kind of time machine, not just to the 90s, but to your own younger self. The person who watched it and didn't yet know how adult life would actually feel.
That's where the prompt's framing is so specific. It's not about whether Friends is good. It's about what happens when the period between watching it and becoming the adult it depicts closes. When you're no longer looking forward to that life, you're looking back at the expectation of it.
There's a melancholy in that. Not a bitter melancholy, just the recognition that some things you thought would be true turned out not to be. And the show is a record of what you thought.
I think that's why the show endures despite everything. Not because it's realistic, but because it's a monument to a specific kind of hope. The hope that adulthood would be a sitcom, solvable, warm, full of people who love you and show up every day.
Adulthood isn't that, but the hope was real, and the show preserves it.
What's the verdict for someone who grew up with the show and is now the age of the characters?
I think you make your peace with it. You appreciate the craft. You acknowledge the limitations. You recognize that the fantasy served a purpose, even if it didn't deliver. And you maybe, occasionally, put on a Thanksgiving episode and let yourself be 12 again for 22 minutes.
That's generous.
I'm a generous sloth.
You're not wrong, though. The show doesn't need to be defended or attacked. It's a cultural artifact. It meant something to people. The meaning has changed as the people have changed. That's not a failure. That's just time doing what time does.
The people who attack it on petty grounds.
The show will survive. It survived worse than think pieces. It survived the 2004 finale, which was watched by 52 million people and was basically a national event. It's fine.
52 million. That's hard to even imagine now. The fragmentation of media means no sitcom will ever have that kind of monocultural reach again.
Which is part of why the show feels like such a time capsule. It's not just a document of the 90s. It's a document of a media landscape that no longer exists. Must-see TV. A shared cultural reference point that everyone understood.
Now we have 1,000 shows and no shared references. Everyone is watching something different. The monoculture is dead.
Friends is one of its last monuments, which maybe explains some of the intensity around it, both the love and the backlash. It's not just a show, it's a symbol of a lost kind of cultural experience.
The last campfire before everyone went into their separate algorithmic bubbles.
I think that's part of why rewatching it now feels so strange. You're not just watching a sitcom, you're watching a broadcast from a world where everyone was watching the same thing.
The show is a fossil of monoculture, and fossils are valuable even when they're no longer alive.
To answer the prompt directly, how did I digest it? I watched it, I loved it, I grew up, I got annoyed by it, I made peace with it, and now I see it as something more interesting than either the fans or the haters give it credit for. It's a document of a particular moment in American culture, a particular fantasy about adulthood, and a particular kind of television that doesn't exist anymore.
The gap between watching it and becoming the adult it depicted.
The gap is the whole story. The gap is where you figure out what you actually want, as opposed to what a sitcom told you to want. The gap is adulthood.
Now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
In the 1930s, naturalist Donald Griffin demonstrated that bats navigate in total darkness by emitting ultrasonic pulses and interpreting the returning echoes. He called this echolocation. Griffin later described bat sonar as operating like an auditory searchlight, a beam of sound with optical properties that function similarly to a flashlight in fog.
An auditory searchlight.
Actually, kind of beautiful.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. You can find every episode at My Weird Prompts. If you've got thoughts on Friends, nostalgia, or the gap between sitcom life and real life, we'd love to hear them. Leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps.
Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.